much do you really know about the Pilgrims? That their epic trip on the Mayflower took them to Plymouth Rock, and then they ate the first Thanksgiving meal with their Indian neighbors? Well, as Nathaniel Philbrick makes clear in his new book, Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War, the Pilgrim myth is at odds with the more compelling and often more violent Pilgrim reality. The book is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Philbrick to my show today. Hello.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Isn't this something of a departure for you? Because your National Book Award winner, In the Heart of the Sea, and then the other book, Sea of Glory, were really sea stories, and this one does have a sea voyage, but that's just a small part of the story.
Well, yes and no. Yes, it begins at sea, but one of the themes I've always had working in my books is that before there was the wilderness of the West, there was the wilderness of the sea. And it was really interesting working this out in Mayflower because it begins at sea. You know, just a horrible passage, that wilderness of water. And then they're on the wilderness of Cape Cod and southeastern Massachusetts, and it's almost seamless. You go from one to the other. And whether it's terrestrial or at sea, it's pretty similar.
But most people actually think it begins in England. And yeah. To a large degree, even before the sea, it was Holland.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Yeah, we think of them as Englishmen fleeing to the New World. Well, for 12 years, many of them had been in Leiden, Holland, one of the most densely packed urban centers in Europe, and they working in the cloth industry, things like this. And so, yeah, they had spent more than a decade in a foreign land and decided to go to America because they were fearful that they were losing their English roots.
But not all of them. Some still stayed in Holland.
Yes, and in fact, the original plan was that they were just going to transplant the entire congregation. But as plans progressed or did not progress, many of the members got cold feet and said, you know, okay, some of you can go, and if you're still alive in a year, maybe we'll come. And as a result, less than half of the group went over, and the minister, John Robinson, stayed behind. And this was not as originally planned, and it really changed the whole character of the settlement.
And the whole story that you tell might have changed as well if John Robinson had come.
Absolutely, because John Robinson was their spiritual leader. I mean, every aspect of their life had really been choreographed by him. And when they were 3,000 miles away from him, they were in a wilderness that went way beyond, you know, the forest. They were in a spiritual wilderness as well.
Did they call themselves pilgrims?
In William Bradford's Of Plymouth Plantation, which is, you know, a seminal text, one of the greatest books ever written in American history and literature, he refers to that. He cites from the Bible and says they knew they were pilgrims. They never referred to themselves as the Pilgrims, but it's as good a name as any for people who really were always on the move, even after they supposedly settled down in the New World.
Weren't they a branch of the Puritan movement?
Right, but they were Puritans with a vengeance. These were separatist Puritans, which meant that they determined that the Church of England was not a Church of God, and that if they were going to worship as they should, they had to remove themselves from that church to separate. And this was illegal in England at the time. So that's why they had gone over to Holland.
But when Oliver Cromwell came to power, would he have welcomed them into the fold?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, it was theologically, there was very little difference between who we call the Pilgrims and the Puritans. And in fact, when the Puritans came over to Boston 10 years later, they were in effect separatists of their own because there were no bishops from England to get in their way. It was very, very marginal differences. It's almost more of a cultural designation. The Pilgrims were the ones that came to Plymouth between 1620 and 1629. The Puritans arrived in Boston after that.
So what happened with the Mayflower? Is this a ship they bought?
It was a ship they basically rented. This was transportation of its day. The Mayflower was at least 10 years old. It may have been a good deal older. And it had done the run from France to England, taking woolens over and wine back. And so she was known as a sweet ship because the spillage of the wine sweetened the stench of the bilge. But after a few months with all those pilgrims aboard, she was no longer a sweet ship.
And would the pilgrims have appreciated all that wine?
Yes. Well, at that time, you know, the worst thing you could do is drink water because it was dangerous. So everyone, children and adults, drank wine and beer. And in fact, they knew they were in trouble aboard the Mayflower when they began to run out of beer at the end of the voyage.
Was everybody on the Mayflower Pilgrim?
No. And that's where the fundamental shift began, even before they got to America. So many pilgrims had gotten cold feet that the merchant adventurers, the investors in England, had to fill up their ranks with what the pilgrims called strangers, people generally from London that were normal Englanders, and that, you know, they believed in the Church of England, but they were not Puritan separatists. And so this created and they were almost half of the, represented half the ship. And so from the beginning, there was a real divide among the passengers of the Mayflower.
And how long did this journey take?
Well, they ran into every problem you could think of. They were had a month of delays trying to leave England. And, you know, and they were on board ship, eating the provisions that were already bare-boned to begin with. And finally, they left months after they were planning to in September. And this was disastrously late because their plan had been to get to the New World with plenty of time to build houses before winter came on. Instead, after 2 months at sea, averaging between 1.5 and 2 miles an hour, they made it to the coast of New England.
Is that where they wanted to go?
No. They wanted to be New Yorkers.
Don't we all?
Yes, and this shows you where the true destiny of this country would ultimately lead. But they were supposed to. Their patent had them setting up on the banks of the Hudson River. But when they made landfall, they were 200 miles away, off Cape Cod, and they tried to sail for their intended destination, but ran into dangerous shoals known as Pollock Rip.
You mentioned a patent. What was the patent?
This was there was a group of noblemen that had been given permission by the king to grant patents, which means an ability to make a settlement in a certain portion of the New World. You didn't own the land, but they gave you a temporary right there, and if you stayed there long enough, you could then get a full right to stay there. So they but their patent did not apply to Cape Cod, where they ended up settling. And this caused a rift among the passengers.
Did they land on Plymouth Rock, as I was taught in school?
There is no evidence of that. I mean, they first came into Provincetown Harbor, spent a couple of months searching for a harbor, finally found Plymouth. But nowhere in Bradford's account and the other accounts that have come down to us is there any mention of a rock. And so that would be some of the later mythologizing.
And that's what happened to much of the story, that later they were just kind of romanticized?
Oh, yeah. You know, the image we have of the pilgrims, which is really a Victorian image, begins really with Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. America needed a restorative myth of national origins, and so he made Thanksgiving a national holiday. And about this time, Longfellow wrote the incredibly popular poem, The Courtship of Miles Standish, and that solidified the image of the pilgrims that has come down to us to this day of pious pioneers of America. And it really bears little resemblance to the truth.
My guest is Nathaniel Philbrick, whose latest book is called Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War, published by Viking. Was the story of Miles Standish true, at least?
Well, you know, Longfellow's poem, if you read all of it, is a lot more detailed than you'd think. But once again, it's a romanticized vision. Miles Standish was the Pilgrim's military officer. He was what we would call today vertically challenged. There are many references to how surprisingly short he was for a military man. In fact, his sword was 6 inches shorter than most, because apparently it would have dragged on the ground otherwise. And he also had an anger management issues, which probably goes with the job he had, but there are several references to him just losing it. And he was responsible for one really brutal attack against some Indians just to the north of Plymouth, in which he returned to the Pilgrim Fort with the head of an Indian warrior, and that was eventually planted on the roof of the fort.
And that wouldn't have upset very religious people?
No. You know, Christians do not necessarily believe in pacifism. In the Bible, there is Joshua, the warrior. And they were Englishmen. And if any Englishman in London, taking the London Bridge, if he looked up, would have seen the heads of notorious traitors on pikes. So this is what happened.
What about the Mayflower Compact? Why was it written and what did it say?
Well, this is really where the mythology has a true kernel of truth. I mean, it's an amazing document in that they realized that they were going to settle outside of where their patent dictated. And at that point, this created a minor insurrection among the passengers. The strangers said, wait a minute, if we're not going where we're supposed to go, we don't have to listen to the rest of you religious radicals. This was disastrous, because if they go in different directions, that's the end of the settlement and probably the deaths of all of them. And so instead of getting Miles Standish to subdue the rebels, they put pen to paper and wrote the Mayflower Compact, which is in which everyone agrees to obey civil government.
And it's come to represent an early symbol of American democracy.
Yes.
But is this a really democratic document?
It's a symbol. Those that say this is the Constitution in utero are really pushing it. I mean, what is important about this document is this is a group of people that are 3,000 miles from home, and they are creating a document to keep themselves in order. And so, I mean, I think that is it was a very pragmatic and noble gesture ultimately, yeah.
You mentioned the Native Americans who were living in the area. What tribes were there?
Well, we call them the Wampanoag today, but that seems to been a name that was used later in the century. The Pokanokets were quite near, seemed to have controlled what would become Plymouth. And their leader was Massasoit. The Pokanokets had endured 3 years of terrible diseases. These were plagues brought from Europe probably by European fishermen. And in some cases, population had been reduced by 90%. Where the Pilgrims settled was a place where there had been between 2,000 and 3,000 Indians. Now there were none.
So Massasoit actually aligned himself with the Pilgrims. Was this done because he was thinking defensively, or was he looking for allies?
He was thinking very creatively, really, because what had happened was the Pokanokets had been devastated by disease, but their rivaling neighbors, the Narragansetts, had not. And so they were about to basically get taken over. And so what Massasoit realized was this small band of Englishmen might provide him with a way to establish once again some kind of parity in the region, and it worked.
My guest is Nathaniel Philbrick, whose latest book is Mayflower. It follows the New York Times bestseller In the Heart of the Sea, which won the National Book Award, and also Sea of Glory, the epic South Seas Expedition, 1832 to 1842, which won the Theodore and Franklin D. Roosevelt Naval History Prize. This book is published by Viking, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Nathaniel Philbrick, whose latest book is called Mayflower. It is published by Viking. We're talking about the local Indians. A bilingual Indian by the name of Squanto emerges as one of the central figures in this story. Who was he, and how did he learn to speak English?
Well, Squanto is a very interesting character. Several years before the Pilgrims arrived, he had been abducted by an Englishman and taken to Spain to be sold as a slave, somehow got himself to England, where he spent some time in London, on London's Cornhill, eventually made his way to Newfoundland, and then became the interpreter for an explorer along the coast, Thomas Dermer. And he was eventually captured by Massasoit, who didn't trust him because Squanto had been, from what became Plymouth, and he seems to have had some ambitions almost from the beginning.
It's interesting that slavery went both ways. We always think of the slaves as having been brought here from Africa, but you're suggesting that slaves were brought from the Americas to Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's America's to, yes, this was some of the tawdry history of the early part of New England, is that these explorers realized that, you know, they could make some extra money by bringing human cargo back.
How do you research this sort of story? After all, the Indians didn't have a written language, and and you do try to tell their side of the story.
It's a real challenge, obviously. But, you know, when you get into it and you look at the primary sources, what you begin to realize is there are a variety of perspectives. It's not as if there's a monolithic English point of view and a monolithic Indian point of view. And you see Englishmen. There was a guy named Thomas Morton who came in a few years after the Pilgrims, who didn't like the Pilgrims and but loved the local Indians. And so he provides all sorts of insights into a native point of view that William Bradford does not provide. And so you try to – it's almost like a detective story, really, and putting these together and try as best you can to recreate the point of views of the actors in this.
How did you
story.
Find out so much about Squanto?
Well, Squanto is interesting. You see it in William Bradford, because the Pilgrims were initially taken in completely. Squanto was exactly what they needed.
He was working both sides against the middle.
Absolutely. And Massasoit clearly did not trust him from the beginning, but what Squanto had was a skill. He knew the English language. And what Squanto also knew is that this meant that he could play both sides. He could tell the English what he wanted them to know about the Indians, and he could tell Massasoit what he wanted them to know about the English. And so he played it really a masterful game for about a year.
He spread rumors that the Pilgrims stored diseases in barrels and could deploy them like weapons.
Yes, yeah, these were 17th century weapons of mass destruction. And he told Massasoit that the Pilgrims had these. And this may have been one of the reasons why Massasoit did eventually align himself. And what Squanto would then do is then told Indians throughout the region that his ties to the English meant that he could determine where this disease went. So you must come to me instead of Massasoit. And so he had ambitions of becoming the next Massasoit.
And obviously he knew that this wasn't true.
Yeah. I mean, he knew the English well enough to know exactly, you know, what they could do and what they could not do. But eventually it all caught up with him, and his plots were revealed. And it put Bradford and the Pilgrims in a very difficult position.
And he wound up dying.
Yeah, he died under very mysterious circumstances. It could have been poisoning. I suspect it is. He died very quickly of disease, and having lived in England for so long, it's highly unlikely that he'd come down with something quite so suddenly.
A lot of the Indians died of European diseases. Was the opposite also true? Did Europeans die from Indian diseases?
Not really, no, because these were diseases that had the Europeans had basically gotten from their animals, avian flu. We're still dealing with them today,
and mostly from pigs. Weren't they?
Pigs, yeah, livestock. You know, they lived beside their cattle, and the Indians did not have this kind of thing, except for dogs. There really were no domesticated animals, and so they did not have the antibodies for these diseases. And you know, there's some speculation that syphilis may have made its way from the native side to the European side, but you know, I don't think that's been proven one way or another.
And there doesn't seem to have been too much intermarriage or mixing of the races in this regard, not similar to what we saw in the Spanish colonies.
Right, or in France, you know, with the Canadians. No, there was very little of that. And
because the Puritans were really Puritans?
No, they had plenty of sex. I mean, those first families in New England averaged between 8 and 9 children. So, but they believed in keeping the other, the wilderness, the Native Americans at arm's length. And but unfortunately for them, or actually fortunately for all of us, there were aspects of the other that they had to incorporate with food ways when it came to corn and all this kind of stuff.
At the same time, you get the feeling that both sides saw the other as the savages.
Absolutely. From a native point of view, here came these hairy monsters, you know, people with these scraggly beards, smelled terrible, you know, focusing on all these strange things, looking for gold and things like that. And yes, these were, I mean, it was as if creatures from Mars had descended. And both sides never really understood each other. And what I find really inspiring about this story is that they were able to come to this alliance and peace reign for a surprisingly long time.
But at the same time, don't you think the Pilgrims would have done better if they had allowed themselves to learn more from the Indians? The Indians had very good agricultural methods.
Yeah, and in truth, they did learn more than they would ever admit. You know, when it came to corn, foodways, there's all sorts of evidence that they would adopt native ways in probably levels they never anticipated.
What about some of the other European groups that were coming to to North America at the time? We had the French, you mentioned,
yep.
And the Dutch, of course. Just around this time, the Dutch bought Manhattan, didn't
right.
they?
Right, and because many of the Pilgrims had been in Leiden for so long, that quickly became a very close relationship. An official from the Dutch colony came up to Plymouth in 1627 and left a wonderful account of a typical Sunday in the plantation. And later on, as the decades would come, there would be a very strong trade between Plymouth Colony and Manhattan. And eventually, the first English mayor of Manhattan would be come from Plymouth Colony. So,
my guest is Nathaniel Philbrick, whose latest book is Mayflower. It is published by Viking. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Were the French and the Dutch also aligning themselves with different tribes?
Every European power was working that angle as hard as they could because, you know, the source of wealth in these early decades was the fur trade. And you needed to have a strong relationship with the Native Americans if you were going to get furs. And so you see them working those alliances in a way, trying to undercut each other and making it very difficult. This was a constantly changing matrix of relationships.
And then what happened when the Puritans started coming over in great numbers? Did they get along with the Pilgrims?
Yes and no. They did initially, and what was amazing is in just a year, suddenly Plymouth went from being the only significant English settlement in the region to being a backwater. You know, they were, in a year, so many Puritans rushed into the Boston area that suddenly and these Puritans were better educated, had more money, and so quickly took the lead when it came to being the cultural arbiters of the region.
But weren't there things that they could learn from the Pilgrims? Because the Pilgrims had been working this land for 10 years by the time they
arrived. Yes, and they did. In terms of the one thing that the Pilgrims had was cattle at this time. And so the Pilgrims experienced quite an economic boom for the next decade as they provided this gush of population with goods. And so it was a very good thing. But then the Puritans had their ambitions, and they one of those ambitions was to take over the Pilgrim trading posts up in Maine and in Connecticut, and then there would be clashes over that.
Do you think that things would have worked out differently if John Robinson hadn't died in Holland in 1625? Was he planning to come over around
yeah,
that time?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the unexpected elements of the Plymouth story for me, is that John Robinson had been their spiritual leader. He didn't come over in the beginning, but they were all waiting for him to come. But in 1625, he died in Leiden. And this was a devastating blow.
There was nobody to replace him?
No, there wasn't. They would have other ministers, but none of them would take. William Brewster was their lay leader, and he would soldier on in terms of their spiritual lives. But you see in William Bradford a real sadness, a profound disquiet about the future of the settlement, because the original plan was to transplant what they had in Leiden, and it would never happen.
And then tensions began to heat up between the Europeans and the Indians. What happened there? Why did King Philip's War erupt?
Well, it's complex, but a lot of it comes down to real estate. As the fur trade dried up. The only thing of value the Native Americans had, as far as the English were concerned, was their land. And by this point, the Native Americans had become dependent on Western goods. And so the lands that everyone thought in the beginning were so boundless that no one had to worry about that began to become very difficult for the Indians to practice their traditional ways on what lands remained. And as the population of the Pilgrims increased, you know, the pressures were exponential.
In the popular culture, the Native Americans didn't believe in ownership of the land. Is
right.
that really true?
Well, they had a totally different attitude towards the land. There wasn't you didn't own things. The sachem, the leader, might be able to say, "Well, you have rights to this land," but the concept of it being yours was not part of their mindset, and so they sort of blundered into this. The English assume this is what happens when two very different peoples interact. They each have misunderstandings of each other, and those continue. But eventually, you know, within a decade, as towns began to spring up, it became clear what the English meant by the buying and selling of land.
And when you say the English, did the tensions bring the Pilgrims and the Puritans together?
Yes and no. They worked with remarkable alignment, but there were also rivals, and there were border disputes all the time. But the one thing they did realize is that as the population of New England increased and tensions with the Indians increased, that they needed to coordinate each other. And so the colonies developed a united colonial confederation, and this did a lot to coordinate things.
Did the Indian tribes also unite?
No. And this is one of those great what-ifs. There were attempts to do it. Maitanomi, who was one of the great Narragansett sachems, realized relatively early on that, you know, this was an end game as far as the Native Americans were concerned. And, you know, we've got to pull together here and strike now before it's too late. But, you know, these were differences that were so deep-seated and so long-standing that the Native Americans had a hard time forgetting those. And so they never really acted as a coordinated unit.
How did it come to be called King Philip's War?
Massasoit, one of his sons was named Philip, and he and his brother, who was named Alexander, had asked for English names. And Philip became sachem of the Wampanoag, and at a time when there was less and less land, and these tensions were reaching a boiling point.
Although you did say they were relying on the Europeans for goods, also for weapons. They had a large arsenal of European weapons. You write that by immediately assuming the conflict was a racial rather than a political struggle, the English were, in effect, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes. When violence breaks out in this war, it happens in June of 1675, there are some atrocities. People are killed, chopped up, those kinds of things. And the equivalent of a modern-day terrorist attack, and it terrified the English. And they began to see the people who they had regarded as their friends as hated, pernicious foes, no matter what their point of view to this conflict was.
In fact, it's impossible to read that without seeing parallels with the current war on terror. Were you thinking about that?
You know, I wrote this book began this book soon after the start of the Iraq War, and you know it was part of the atmosphere I was breathing at that point, you know, and it's always dangerous to make those parallels too close, but our past is there to instruct us, and there are many important aspects of King Philip's War that I think would be lessons well learned today.
What was its outcome?
Well, it was a horrible, dirty war that lasted only 14 months. For a while, it looked like the Indians might take it. Many English feared they would be driven to the sea. But by the spring of 1676, a year into the war, the Indians were running out of food. They were unable to plant their corn because they're in the middle of a war, while the English had England to provide them with provisions and weapons. And so even though the English were losing it on the field, the Indians began to starve, and it became a war of attrition. And eventually Philip would be killed in August of 1676.
And many died, and others were enslaved, weren't they?
Yeah. And, you know, and this is where, you know, the story of the Pilgrims is a truly American story, and it involves the issue of slavery. And one of the outrages that some thought the English did was to take Indians who had willfully surrendered, thinking that, you know, this would get them out of the war. The English, who were thought all Indians were bad Indians, loaded them into ships and sold them as slaves in the Caribbean.
And what happened to the original Pilgrim, or the Plymouth settlement? Did it just fizzle out?
Well, it became just another little town in Plymouth Colony. And by that time, many of the first families had moved out to other towns. And this was a process that deeply disturbed Governor Bradford. And eventually, soon after this war, that half the towns in New England were burned during this war. It was horrible. But soon after this war, Plymouth Colony would be absorbed by Massachusetts, and so would end the old colony.
Many people talk about the puritanical attitudes of Americans. Can we really attribute them to these people?
A yes and no to this. I mean, these pilgrims, if you look at today's American population, 10%, it's estimated that 10% of the American population are descended from the passengers on the Mayflower. That's more than 34 million people. There is a direct connection to who we are as a nation and to who we were in the 17th century.
Nathaniel Philbrick's latest book is Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War. It is published by Viking, and it follows his New York Times bestseller in the Heart of the Sea, which won the National Book Award, and also Sea of Glory, the epic South Seas Expedition 1832-1842, which is the winner of the Theodore and Franklin D. Roosevelt Naval History Prize. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a great pleasure.